Welcome to This Is Money podcast. I'm Georgie Frost, and joining me and editor Simon Lambert today is pensions and investments editor Tanya Jeffries. And coming up, like London buses and other such cliches, you wait forever for one and then three interest rate rises come along at once. Will it do anything to rising inflation? And what does it mean for our money? Also today, it's ISA season, that time of the year to stuff those tax-free little gems with as much of your 20 grand allowance as you can before you lose it. But how and where to invest in these troubled times? Tanya has some ideas and tips for us, plus tax on Bitcoin profit, and Currys launches cash for trash. But make sure you wipe those old devices first. Don't forget, you can stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. But first, the Bank of England decided to raise the base rate of interest for the third time on the bounce this week, this time by 25 basis points to 0.75%. Could we see 2% by the end of the year? So was it the right move in the current circumstances with households already well and truly under the cosh? Or should they have gone even higher, perhaps, to manage this runaway inflation? Simon, did you see it coming?
No. Well, I did, because it was almost certain that it was going to happen. But I must admit, whilst I am someone who has argued long years that the Bank of England should be raising interest rates sooner than it has done, I think that we left them on the floor for too long after the financial crisis. I think we left them on the floor for too long after the Brexit vote. I think we left them on the floor for too long after the COVID lockdowns. I don't think that the 0.1% interest rate that we introduced as the COVID first struck and the lockdowns first struck still needed to be there all that time later, right up until December last year. But I think I've got Stockholm syndrome. I think I've fallen in love with my low interest rate loving captors. And so I never expected that they would get from 0.1% to 0.75% between December last year and March this year. This is astonishing. For those of us who spent many long, lonely years waiting for rate rises, it got to the point, in all honesty, post-financial crisis, where you just batted off an interest rate decision day like anything. It used to be really exciting. Will it go up? Will it go down? Should we prep a story? What are we going to do? It's just like, oh, yeah, they're not going to go anywhere. Yeah, they're not going to go anywhere. Yeah, they're not going to go anywhere. And then all of a sudden, they just started going up. It's crazy. I don't know what they're thinking. It's almost like they're doing monetary policy or something crazy like that.
Maybe, Tanya, maybe. Simon asked a fair question. What are they thinking? What were they thinking? They told us because they released all these statements about it. But tell us what they were thinking.
Yeah, they have told us, and it's obviously inflation. After suggesting that inflation wouldn't get that high or would be, you know, transitory or pass quickly because of temporary supply chain issues, then now they started taking it a lot more seriously in December, from what I can see. And I believe that is the reason that they've really gone for it now. Because if inflation expectations get out of hand and people start demanding wage rises, inflation could get really out of hand a lot faster. In a way, there is an argument for going hard and going fast at the beginning to cut that off. And even though the inflation that we've got, you could argue very strongly it's really got nothing to do with things that they've got control over in this scenario, and that actually even the interest rate rise wouldn't actually tackle the causes, like the energy price rises that we've got the as a result of the war and about the supply chain issues. They can't directly control that. The fact that they're acting and they're showing they're acting does have an impact on expectations, and it's my theory, for what it's worth, that is what's behind a lot of what they're doing. I'd also just like to point out that they do actually seem to be very worried about going too far, what they term sort of the downside risks of, you know, GDP growth down the line. And maybe they're even worried that, you know, inflation will go back in the wrong direction once the supply chain issues are sorted out. But there is a real risk that they could overshoot, and that, you know, it will contribute along with a lot of other things that are going on: the cost of living crisis, inflation itself, the national insurance rise, and it will, you know, have a very bad impact on the economy. I think they're trying to squash it really hard, really fast, but I wouldn't be surprised if they then slow down. I know that sounds strange to say, but I could foresee maybe even a couple more rate rises in quick succession, but then them easing off at the first sign of trouble or inflation easing.
With that in mind, Simon, Tanya spoke about the major impact on inflation at the moment. There's not really a lot that the Bank of England can do about that. Where can it impact, apart from essentially, I guess what you're saying, Tanya, is sentiment?
Well, this is the difficult situation that the Bank of England and its rate setters face. And it's somewhat ironic for those of us who have long argued that we need to raise interest rates. My case for raising interest rates is that they need to be higher than 0.1%, because ideally you just don't want interest rates at 0.1%. It doesn't leave you anywhere to go when you've got problems, and it starts to cause all kinds of distortions in the economy due to money being so cheap. Effectively, you know, it's free. Borrowing money is free. Mm. In fact, borrowing money is still free because the rate of inflation is way above where the base rate is. But
do we have a target like we do in inflation? They say it's about 2%. Is there something like a good base rate that we want to kind of stick around?
No, there isn't. And it does lead to the question of whether there should be, but then you run the risk of the tail wagging the dog, don't you? Hang on, what are we trying to do with this inflation number? There has been the suggestion, actually, a number of times in the past, that the inflation target should be more flexible, in that targeting 2% inflation the whole way through is a mistake, because actually you need to target an inflation figure related to the current circumstances and what the circumstances are expected to be in the short to medium term future, rather than just a number that was put on the inflation target when the Bank of England was given independence in terms of rate setting from the government. And there is an argument that the 2% inflation target was too high in the past, when we were importing deflation from other countries, for example, the great globalization boom, the cheap money, the savings glut, that kind of stuff. So we were effectively trying to get inflation up to 2% when there were factors meaning that you're almost fighting a losing battle, and that causes distortions in the market by keeping money too cheap for too long, the aftermath of the financial crisis, for example. And you could put forward the argument now that the inflation target is too low because, for example, most of the inflation is coming from, as you said, rapidly rising energy prices, rapidly rising oil prices. We're going to see food prices going up. We're seeing a huge disruption and distortion of markets from the after effects of COVID and the lockdowns. For example, the semiconductor shortage that has meant the supply of new cars has been massively crimped and sent the cost of used cars through the roof. So set against that, you could say, well, actually, maybe the inflation target needs to be higher. The problem is, as I said, is you risk the tail wagging the dog in that kind of scenario, whereby you're shifting it up and down all the time just to suit yourselves. And I think the whole idea behind Bank of England rate setting independence and an inflation target was to stop setting interest rates based on what suits yourself, which is something governments have a tendency to do when they're in control of the interest rates. So yes, that's the long answer to no, this probably doesn't make any difference whatsoever to any of the inflation that we're seeing at the moment. But if you look at the purpose of monetary policy, the idea is that effectively it's really simple. You increase the cost of borrowing, and by increasing the cost of borrowing, you lower the demand to do it. And when you lower the demand for people to borrow, for example, businesses, or in a large case in this country, mortgages, then banks create less money because they press less of the button that creates 200 grand for you to go buy that house. And that slows down, you know, the velocity of money, it reduces the money supply, all these other things. And we had warnings about this inflation scenario where we ran an article in May 2020 by someone who's written regularly for This Is Money, a guy called Pete Comley, who is a bit of an inflation expert. He'd written a book and he said, totally underestimating the prospects of inflation spiking in the 2020s. Everybody's convinced that we're still in this low inflation world. Same thing's going to happen after the financial crisis. We can get away with all of the quantitative easing, the money printing, the cheap money and all that other stuff because we didn't get inflation from it before. But this time it's different because we're handing money directly to people and you're going to see a big disruption coming out the back of this and in the recovery and stuff like that. And we're going to see inflation spike. And I mean, largely speaking, that theory was correct. But I think that, and I always thought inflation was going to spike as well. I must admit, though, I thought inflation was going to start tailing off by now. I thought that it was going to spike and then go down, not maybe as transitory as the central bankers thought, but I thought it was going to be a bit more transitory than what now looks very persistent. But you've got this added element of the Russia-Ukraine war coming into play here, which the Bank of England said is going to potentially push inflation even higher. So it had previously suggested it was going to peak at around 7.25%. And yesterday it said inflation is expected to increase further in coming months to around 8% in the second quarter of 2022, and perhaps even higher later this year. Do you see what they've done there with the "and perhaps even higher later this year"? They don't want to put a number on it that's higher than 8%. So they've gone, oh, perhaps even higher. The thing is, there's only one number after 8 before you get to double-digit inflation. Yeah. So I can see what they've done there. I can see exactly what they've done there. But yeah, I guess there's every chance it could hit 10%. And if you had said that to people, even this time last year, but certainly in the summer and autumn coming in 2020, as we were sort of coming out of the initial first wave of COVID, they'd have said you were completely mad. Inflation was never going to hit 10%. We've been trying to get inflation up to 2% for years. It ain't hitting 10%. But it's quite likely that it's going to happen now.
Goodness me. Tanya, let's get into what it means for savers, for borrowers, this interest rate rise. Let's start with investors being the expert.
As far as investors go, we've been doing some big roundups of investing ideas and tips ahead of the end of the ISA season. And obviously the experts are taking all the current issues into account. The message is diversify. That's always what they say. But also look to long-term growth. Look to long-term growth stories. Look through what's going on at the moment, in other words. A lot of them are suggesting that you use up your ISA allowance, but put it in cash and then drip feed it in to investments in the coming year, which is often a sound idea if you're trying to use up your ISA allowance and invest it in a volatile period. And also they say when you're choosing investments at this kind of time, you've got to be really careful and look at what you already own. In other words, don't draw up a list of all the various sort of funds and shares and so on that would be good for right now, but look at what you've got and try and plug the gaps in what you own already, as opposed to going mad trying to construct a portfolio or shift a portfolio into just what the current circumstances are.
I was interested in reading an article about buys and rent-a-kill. Even if it goes up, prices go up 5%, you still don't want those rats and mice in your home. Fair point. Is that what you look at? What we're always going to need and we're happy to pay a bit more for?
Yeah, that's something that people often do. And we talked about this in the past about companies with pricing power. And unsurprisingly, Diageo is on the list as well, because people are always going to carry on drinking. We've done two features, one on share ideas and one on fund ideas. Other suggestions on the shares front is EMIS or EMIS Group. They supply software to GPs and pharmacies. That, again, you can kind of see, yeah, we can carry on needing that. Another one is Tritax Big Box Investment Trust. They're an owner of big distribution centres. And I suppose that's leaning into the sort of home delivery trend, the idea that we're going to carry on needing distribution solutions and so on. As far as funds go, they can be divided into a few different areas. On the fund and trust feature, we've got 14 suggestions. So if you are looking for ideas, there's a huge range that our experts have come up with. They are suggesting that the UK, because it's been cheap and therefore has got potential to grow, is a good idea. Dividend payers, going for income. Again, one expert suggested Redwheel UK Equity Income as one. The usual suggestion about capital preservation, personal assets trust, that always comes up with that one. And also going global as well. And that's, I guess, looking into the long-term trends. There's one fund that suggested Aubrey Global Market Opportunities. And that is rather interestingly leaning into the rising middle class in emerging markets, particularly in India, which you can see that, I mean, that's going to continue obviously on the other side of all this. And we've also got a couple of mining ones. Black World Mining Trust was recommended by two experts. Actually, I think it's obvious why it might be an option at the moment to have a commodity play. Also, Jupiter Gold and Silver was recommended. One thing that came up, which I don't think I mentioned last time we discussed, you know, investing when inflation is getting really out of hand, was one expert suggested going for these trusts that are owned by rich people, so the Rothschilds and so on. There's another as one, Caledonian as well, which I believe is listed in the UK. The idea being that these are very long-term, very, very stable companies that are owned by families with generations of wealth. They might not be the safest play around, but long-term, the volatility is likely to be ironed out. They presumably know what they're doing. And also, apparently, this is interesting, they're not very correlated with the indexes, the stock market. So therefore, you've got a bit of diversification there, potentially, especially if you maybe have a tracker or so on as maybe one of your core holdings.
Thank you very much, Tanya. Lots in that. Simon, just to go back to the rising interest rates and investors, let's do economics 101. How will a decision like that, will it impact?
Yes. So I think what we need to look at, if you want to zoom out and look at the big picture here, is that over the last two decades, since the turn of the millennium, the backdrop to the rise and fall of stock markets and the one of the fundamental elements driving financial decisions and behavior has been persistently low inflation and low interest rates. Now, that's been the case for consumers, for savers, for businesses, for investors, for central bankers, and for governments. We've had some bouts of inflation, certainly in the UK we have, more than some other countries. We've seen rates go up and go down. But the overall trend has been deflationary pressures and rock bottom interest rates. And to put that in perspective, when I took my first mortgage out, it was a 5-year fix at 4.99%. And that was considered exceptionally cheap money, which sounds a bit crazy in the days of 5-year fixes you could get at just above 1%, and no more because they've gone now. But that was still considered very cheap money. So that's the backdrop to this. And through that, we have seen the financial crisis. We've seen the early 2000s boom, the credit boom. We saw the bust, we saw the financial crisis. And then we've seen the big long bull market after that. We saw the COVID crash. We saw things rebound incredibly quickly from COVID. And the reason why COVID caused markets to crash was because pretty much the entire world went into lockdown. People were told, don't go to work, don't leave your house, don't do all the stuff that keeps our economies going. And obviously there was a big crash, but we came out the back of that and saw markets rally very sharply because we were ultimately considered to be in the same conditions. Low inflation, loads and loads of cheap money, low interest rates, and more of it. Okay, you saw central bank and government largesse on an unbelievable scale. That, I think, has changed. I wrote my column about this week. It's different this time is one of the most dangerous things anybody can ever utter in the world of investing. And it's used to justify all kinds of bubbles. But sometimes you can overlook that it might be different this time. Things might have changed. And I think that there is a strong case to make for the fact that we are no longer in the deflationary, super low interest rate world. We have turned a corner. Things don't last forever. And so maybe you need to look at your investments in your portfolio and consider what might do well or what might do better in the circumstances that we might be going into rather than the past 20 years that we were in. And there's lots of investments that have done very, very well, particularly the US growth tech disruptive kind of story over the last decade or so. And maybe that won't be the same in an era where money's not getting cheaper, where deflation isn't our biggest concern, where inflation is our biggest concern. Now, that's not to say that the really good companies that are genuinely disruptive there won't do very well. I mean, this has been taken as the end is nigh for the Scottish mortgage style investing, and it's all about buying cheap stocks and value and old-fashioned, old economy kinds of things, miners, oil companies, things like that. well, if you speak to the managers of Scottish Mortgage, they'll tell you that they don't invest for 1 year, 2 year, 5 year. They invest for 10 years, 20 years, and they are trying to buy the companies that are highly disruptive and are going to make outsized gains, the outliers, the best companies, the outliers in the world. And actually they tell you that, you know, they get characterized as maybe a techie fund, but they're not a techie fund. They'll say, look, we're actually more interested in what's going on in healthcare and stuff like that at the moment. Now they might be right. Okay. And it might be that the companies that they're suffering at the moment because market sentiment's turned against them, but over the long term, the companies they're picking are going to do spectacularly well. But it also might be that those companies do well and people just don't value them quite as highly in the future as they do now. When growth is in short supply, you know, you'll pay up for it. But when you've got inflation running hot and you've got companies making money right now that you can just buy their shares for cheaper, sometimes people will do that. I did an interview with Stephen Yu, the manager of the Blue Whale Growth Fund, the other day. And he was talking about his portfolio. And his has got quite a few American techie names in it. And we had a conversation around kind of growth investing and how there's different elements of growth investing. Growth investing gets characterized as this moonshot, you know, high risk, will it pay off? Will they change the world kind of stock picking style? But it can just be about picking more resilient growth companies. So for example, he's got rid of Facebook in his portfolio because whilst he still thinks it's a good company, it's still going to make money for years to come. He thinks it's spending an awful lot of money for a very uncertain prospect with this whole metaverse adventure that it's going on. Whereas he still holds Adobe and Microsoft because he thinks they're going to keep growing and people are going to keep spending money on them. And they're essential to people's businesses. They have the pricing power that we were talking about a minute ago. So it's not necessarily only about this polarization of growth and value, because it's not that you've just got one at one end and one at the other and there's nothing in the middle. There is a spectrum in between them. And I think that it is a good time for maybe people to take a look at their portfolios, have a bit of a spring clean, think about what they're investing in and why they're investing in it. But I do think you need to be careful not to chop and change unnecessarily, sell out just after stuff has fallen heavily.
Exactly.
And crystallize your losses. And also that old saying, don't throw the baby out with the bathwater.
So that's a really good point, though. If stuff has gone down quite substantially, yeah, what do you do?
Well, I mean, one thing you could do is try to go bottom fishing, try to go buy it on the cheap. So for example, if you want to buy a Scottish Mortgage, it's 40% cheaper than it was. It's on sale. Now, if you believe in the investing philosophy and you believe in the stock picking skills and you believe in its long-term track record and that will be continued, then you might think that Scottish Mortgage is now a value stock or a value investment trust because you're getting to buy in on the cheap. But you are investing into a more uncertain, high-risk strategy. But then if you're doing that, you might be the kind of person who thinks that the biggest mistake you could make is buying oil companies and airlines and things like that.
Tanya?
Interestingly, Scottish Mortgage was not recommended for, you know, people's experts' best fund ideas. But I have been working on something that hasn't been published yet on junior ISAs. And interestingly, Scottish Mortgage was tipped as a good buy for a child because it's a long-term play and you can afford to take some risk, especially if you're doing it when your child is born and setting it up in 18 years' time. I mean, that's the kind of time frame Scottish Mortgage would be looking at. So as Simon says, if you believe that they can pick the right companies that are going to do really well, then, and they've got the ability to do that, then maybe that's something for a child taking the really long view.
All right, well, that's investors and kids. Simon, Tanya mentioned earlier about savers and she hopes that this interest rate rise will be passed on to savers. Is she dreaming, Simon?
Maybe, but we saw some of it already. Yorkshire Building Society. Let's give credit where credit's due. Off the mark, yesterday afternoon, we're going to pass the rate rise on to our savers. So bravo, Yorkshire Building Society. Many of the big banks have totally failed to pass on a lot of the rate rises to their savers, yet mortgage rates are going up. Read into that what you will. This is what always happens. I think that ultimately we are going to see savings rates improve, and we have seen savings rates improve. We're still not at 1% on an easy access rate, though. So, you know, that's still quite a long way below inflation, which is most recently 5.5%. And as the Bank of England said, 8%, or maybe higher.
Okay, so savers, borrowers.
Mortgage rates are going up. They have been going up for some time. The rock bottom rates of maybe 6 to 9 months ago have gone. Borrowers are looking at paying quite a bit more in terms of interest rate terms, maybe 0.5% than they were back then. But it has to be said that mortgage rates are still exceptionally cheap. Mm-hmm. Most people coming off a 2 or a 5 year fix are probably going to find that they can get a mortgage round about the same rate that they're coming off. They're just not going to be in that scenario where their mortgages get cheaper every time, which for many people has been the case. They've probably paid themselves down on the mortgage, on a repayment mortgage. They might have jumped a loan to value band. That's the thing to think about, is you might have taken out an 85% mortgage. Maybe now you're at 75%, you can get a better deal. The advice for anybody who has a mortgage coming up for renewal this year, so you could say within the next 6 months, because you can book them ahead 6 months, but I would say anybody this year, start looking at it now. If you're ahead of that 6 months, then yes, you probably can't do anything about it, because you could have to pay an early repayment charge and things like that, and that will cost you more money. But just start looking into it, so you go into it forewarned and forearmed. And if you go to thisismoney.co.uk/mortgage-finder, you will find our calculator powered by London & Country. You can put in your home's value, you can put in your mortgage amount, you can put in 2-year, 5-year, 3-year, longer than 5 years or whatever for the fix, and you can see how much it's going to cost you. So go do that. Make sure you're prepared, basically, is the advice.
Good advice, Simon, as always. Tanya, just briefly, you've laid out the arguments for why this needs to be done or should be done, or it's not a bad idea that it's done. But if you are someone paying the mortgage, paying energy bills, driving a car, you are just going to look at this added extra and think, oh, good Lord. We do have a spring statement coming up next week. Are you expecting any help?
I hope so. And I think that there needs to be some targeted relief are the people who are at the absolute sharpest end, particularly of energy bills. I got a message from one of my energy suppliers giving me the bad news that my annual bill was going to go up 50%, and it spelled it out in no uncertain terms. I was quite horrified. If I was a pensioner on a low income, I would just be distraught, frankly, because I would have no way of doing it. Age UK has been running a really strong campaign, particularly for energy bills for older people who actually need to have their heating up. And also, it's been pointed out as well on energy bills that the people who are ill often or disabled, they need to run a lot of equipment at home, and that pushes their bills up as well. Rishi Sunak doesn't seem minded to be particularly generous, but I think that if you are going to tackle this, some thinking about some properly targeted, sophisticated measures that will really, really help the people most in need are what is required. And I think people will understand that. I mean, I know that everybody is worried about the middle class and, you know, wealth taxes and so on. But there are lots of people in this country who are absolutely living on the poverty line. They don't know where the next meal is coming from. I would just really like a properly thought out support package for them.
Indeed. Well, we shall see next week. Simon, I said I was going to leave interest rates. I'm not going to quite yet, because it wasn't just over here that we got an interest rate rise. What's the impact of the Fed?
In global terms, far more impactful. Is that a word? Impact is a noun, isn't it? I know quite often it's used as a verb, and there are some people who have a real bugbear with that.
Americans use it, so that's fine. Yes. It goes with the theme.
Yeah, what's the impacting?
How's it impacting?
Yeah, and the impact of that
on a
global scale is far greater than the Bank of England raising interest rates, because the US is the economy that leads the way in global terms. And actually, it's interesting that the Fed is slightly behind us in raising rates, because they've been ahead of us since the financial crisis in doing so. They have outlined a fairly aggressive rate rise scenario for the rest of the year, potentially another 6 or 7 rises. That's quite a lot in a short space of time. Markets took it on the chin. It was widely expected they were going to raise rates this week. It's widely expected they're going to continue doing it. And again, it just feeds into that whole, this is a changing in the mood thing, because certainly in the post-financial crisis rate rise scenario, they weren't quite so aggressive in their kind of statements of intent as they have been this time around. Now, whether it'll actually happen or not, who knows? But you've got to remember that in America, they're slightly more protected against some of this inflation that we're suffering, although inflation is actually higher in America than it is here. But they are a little bit more energy secure than we are.
Inflation bothers everybody in all countries, but it's interesting, the political culture is slightly different over there. They're absolutely obsessed with petrol prices, or gas prices, as they call it, whereas politically here, when we talk about inflation, there really is a concentration, isn't there, on heating your home and so on. And I think that might play into what goes on in the States as well.
Yeah, there's a tax element there in the gas prices in the US, because a lot more of our petrol is tax. The shift in the oil price, this is going to be no consolation to anybody who's filled a car up recently. I paid £96 to fill mine up the other day, so it definitely feels like it has gone up a lot. But actually, the shift in the oil price makes more of an impact on their prices at the pumps, I believe, than it does to us, and that's due to the tax softening element. It's funny to think that tax can be softening it's quite so much on a litre of petrol.
Well, let's stick with tax, shall we? We're going to leave the rest to one side, inflation and interest rates and all that, but we have a reader question. I, obviously, invested 10,000 in Bitcoin in late 2020. And despite its fall from the peak in November, I've still roughly trebled my money. Thinking now about selling half and investing into some investment trust to take advantage of lower prices after recent market falls, do I have to pay capital gains tax if I sell 15 grand's worth of Bitcoin? I haven't made any other gains this tax year. Simon?
So you'd think the answer is yes, you're selling £15,000 worth. The capital gains tax allowance is £12,300. Mm-hmm. You do need to pay some tax, but you only pay tax on your profit. And you need to take into account what that £15,000 worth of Bitcoin cost you. So if that £15,000 of Bitcoin, for example, is something that has trebled in value, going back to the original £10,000 investment, then your £15,000 you're selling cost you £5,000. So you've actually only made a £10,000 profit, and therefore you don't need to pay capital gains tax. You probably do still need to report this on your tax return if you fill in the self-assessment tax return. Interestingly, there is a scenario, though, where people might think that they don't have to pay any tax whatsoever on this because it's a cryptocurrency. And because it's a currency, it doesn't matter. So you don't have to pay because you don't pay capital gains tax on currencies. It's an investment. The tax man has made that abundantly clear, that most people buy crypto as an investment and it's considered as an investment, and if you're investing or trading in crypto, then it is liable for capital gains tax. But there is a wider issue here, which is it's now the 18th of March. That means the 5th of April is not very long away. Your capital gains tax allowance of £12,300 for this year, if you do have some stuff that is outside of an ISA that is likely to incur capital gains tax, you may want to consider crystallizing some of those gains now, if you can get it within the allowance, because that means that you can use this year's allowance, because once we go over into the next year's tax year, that allowance isn't there anymore for you to use if you want to sort of cash in some of your profits. And there is also the fact that not only do you have to pay capital gains tax on things, you can offset your losses against it. So for example, if you've made a loss on something, if you've made a loss on crypto, you can actually, if you do sell that, you can offset that against your gains on other things, for example, stocks. So capital gains tax is one of those things that people rarely think about until they suddenly realize that they've got to pay a tax bill, and then they get really annoyed by it. It is something that's worth thinking about as you go along, And it's also a very good reason why you should always try to invest in an ISA first, because then you just don't have to worry about it. But you can't put cryptocurrency in an ISA.
This question was interesting for other reasons as well. They want to take some profits, obviously, on their Bitcoin, but they say they've got their eye on some investment trusts that they want to buy. I would say, feeding into diversification, that sounds like a good idea, especially if you made a lot on Bitcoin. Maybe you should take some profits on the get on with it and do it sooner rather than later front. It's not only the end of the tax year you need to think about. It is possible that Rishi Sunak will, maybe not in the spring statement, but at some point do something about capital gains tax. And if he does, I would assume that he's not going to make it more generous. The suggestion is, from their own tax experts, the Office for Tax Simplification, they suggested actually cutting the allowance to 2,000, which would be very dramatic, and aligning the capital gains rates with income tax, which would be a big jump, particularly for higher rate taxpayers.
All right, then. Finally, Currys has launched a cash for trash trial scheme. It enables customers with old, broken or unwanted tech to trade the items at its stores for at least a £5 voucher. Seems a very sensible idea, Simon.
It does seem a very sensible idea. I'm sure that there are lots of people out there with many old devices and mobile phones sitting around, and they would otherwise be either continuing to sit around for many, many years to come or heading for landfill. Much better to hand them in, have some use made of them. They can perhaps be pulled apart, components recycled, try to get that whole circular economy thing going. Don't just buy it, use it, bin it, buy it, use it, reuse it, reuse what you can. Really important. Probably the best thing we can do for the environment is getting into that culture. There is a concern for people, though, and that's the whole personal data thing. Because if you are handing in an old phone or an old laptop or an old iPad, you want to make sure that all of your stuff is genuinely wiped from it. You may have personal financial details on there. You may have other personal things on your phone. Some people do. But yeah, you need to be careful about that stuff. And so you need to make sure that you properly wipe your phone before you do it. And also, I mean, maybe look at the possibility of whether you can donate some of these things to charity as well, because there are charities out there who'd like to take these things off people. And perhaps instead of getting Currys to pay you, you could give it to someone who needs the help and assistance more.
Yeah, very good. Very good. All right, then, you can keep up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. And if you have any comments or questions for the team or anything you'd like them to look into, Simon?
You can email us at editor@thisismoney.co.uk. You can tweet us at thisismoney, or you can come to thisismoney.co.uk/podcast to find all podcasts past.
Marvellous. And if you like our podcast, why not rate us on iTunes? It helps people find us.